Talking History in our special President's Day program. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Clearly, the major news item of the past several months has been the impeachment of President William Jefferson Clinton. However, it's also a major event in history because it is only the second time in the nation's history such a step has been taken. In a moment, we'll step back from recent developments to look at the history of presidential impeachment. We'll be speaking to Ross Baker, professor of political science at Rutgers University. But first, let's look at an important event from this week in history. On February 18th, we might pause to remember another president, one that doesn't usually come to mind on President's Day, Jefferson Davis. It was on February 18, 1861, that Jefferson Davis was sworn in as president of the Confederate States of America. It was the start of America's Civil War, and Davis was elected the Confederacy's first and only president. For that honor, when the war ended, Davis was imprisoned and charged with treason and complicity in Lincoln's assassination. The complicity charge was dropped, and his trial for treason was delayed for 2 years, at which time Davis was released on bail. Davis was indicted once again in 1868, but his trial was suspended pending an appeal to the United States Supreme Court on a motion entered by the defense. Before the appeal could be heard, President Andrew Johnson issued a general amnesty proclamation freeing Davis from the charges brought against him, but he never held public office again. Turning to items of interest in the news, contrary to popular belief, most American assassins and would-be assassins are not motivated by deep political convictions, nor do most of them suffer from serious mental ailments. According to a study recently completed by the U.S. Secret Service of 83 assassins and would-be assassins from the past 50 years, most act to achieve notoriety or fame, to bring attention to a personal or public problem, to achieve a perceived wrong, to end personal pain, to save the country or the world, to develop a special relationship with the target, or to make money. In another study, this one by the U.S. Historical Society, has polled the nation's history professors to determine lists of important people and events of the century and millennium. Its list of the 15 most important people of this millennium includes Winston Churchill, Christopher Columbus, Copernicus, Charles Darwin, Albert Einstein, Sigmund Freud, Johann Gutenberg, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther, Isaac Newton, Napoleon Bonaparte, William Shakespeare, Otto von Bismarck, and George Washington. You are listening to Talking History. This week, we celebrate President's Day. What better time to consider the subject on nearly everyone's mind for the better part of the last year, presidential impeachment. But let's break away from the news for just a moment and take a look at the history of impeachment. Only two American presidents have ever been impeached, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton. But the history of impeachment is far richer than that short list of cases might suggest. Here to help us better understand that history is Ross K. Baker. Mr. Baker is currently professor of political science at Rutgers University. He served as a research associate at the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C., and as a member of the staffs of Senator Walter Mondale and the Senate Committee on the Judiciary. He's the author of several books, including American Government, Friend and Foe in the U.S. Senate, House and Senate, and The New Fat Cats. Welcome, Professor Baker, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Brian. And
over the past 200 years plus since we've been working under the U.S. Constitution, impeachment of federal officials, especially judges, has been used a number of times, 60 according to one of my sources, but only twice, three times if you include Nixon, in the case of presidents. Why are we so reluctant to use this when it comes to our presidents?
Well, I think that there's a general recognition that impeachment, while an ordinary constitutional remedy for a misbehaving president, is also an extraordinary remedy. I think that one of the fears that has been unleashed in the current debate over impeachment is that if it becomes too easy, it becomes a routine rather than an extraordinary measure. And certainly the framers of the Constitution were concerned about this. I think they were concerned about the very fact of impeachment unleashing a lot of public passion, a lot of unpleasant partisanship in the public as a whole. And the often cited Federalist Number 65 says this pretty eloquently. Alexander Hamilton, writing in Federalist 65, says that that impeachments will list all animosities, partialities, influences, and interests on one side or the other, and in such cases there will always be the greatest danger that decision will be regulated more by the comparative strength of parties than by real demonstrations of innocence or guilt. So I think they recognized that it was going to be a political process, but it would be a political process that was unlikely to unleash some pretty strong passions. And I think they certainly wanted to avoid that, and I think there's been a general understanding that it is, in a sense, the penalty of last resort.
Well, this, of course, has led to the debate over what we mean by high crimes and misdemeanors, because I think they would agree with what you said, that it should only be used in extraordinary cases. But how do we then regulate presidents who are guilty, let's say, of lesser crimes, if that's the term?
Well, I think that, of course, the debate has raged over not only the facts of the controversy, but also, of course, the argument made by the president's lawyers that even if the president were guilty of perjury and obstruction of justice, that they wouldn't be serious enough. So, in a sense, that's sort of their fallback position. If a determination had been made that indeed the president had been guilty of those two things. So I think in the normal course of events, I think certainly the president has to stand up to a kind of a political test. That if a president does something that is out of line, it becomes known, presumably the public would be outraged by this. But clearly in this particular case, that check of public opinion doesn't seem to be operating. In fact, quite the contrary. It seems like every new revelation about the president seems to increase his standing in the public. For presidents, of course, in their first term, there's always the possibility that they will face the electorate again and be punished there. And then there's also the fact that Congress, after all, does have the power of the purse, and if the president is stepping out of line, they can use that against him, as Congress did, for example, against President Nixon and the conduct or the expansion of the war in Southeast Asia in the 1970s. But the presidency was also constructed, I think, with the idea that that there were going to be very considerable checks on the presidency, that the president was not going to be the King of England, and that that the normal limitations of checks and balances and separation of powers would be enough to keep presidents in line. And if that didn't work, only then would the great weapon of a final judgment, the impeachment, be used.
So impeachment is not the only alternative then?
No, it isn't, really. What happens is I think that there has probably been at least one member of Congress during every presidency who has uttered the word impeachment. I think that some people feel that it is something that should be used when there's strictly a political disagreement. And certainly in the case of Andrew Johnson, what you had was an impeachment based on a very, very straightforward political disagreement. I don't think there was any hint that Andrew Johnson had violated the Constitution in any way, but that merely he had defied the will of Congress because there was a difference of opinion over Reconstruction policy. Congress passed the so-called Tenure of Office Act. Johnson, defying the Tenure of Office Act, fired some major officials who were serving, and on that basis he was impeached. So there was, I think, very much a kind of political dimension to that, even more so, I think, than the Clinton situation.
a political dimension, but then at least we're looking at a clear or relatively clear-cut situation where there was a law passed and Johnson violated the law. Now, I understand the law was later ruled unconstitutional
right,
and appealed.
Right, it was. It took a while. In the case of Myers versus United States, in effect, the Tenure of Office Act was nullified by the Supreme Court, and they said simply that although it's true that the Senate confirms presidential nominations, that once confirmed, that those individuals serve at the pleasure of the president. So, you know, that was there was a constitutional dimension to it, but the origins of it were purely political. And I suppose one could argue that the origins of the present situation are political, too, in that a group of attorneys championing the case of Paula Jones really kind of kept this thing alive. And ultimately, of course, established a connection through the grand jury to the whole question of perjury and obstruction of justice in a federal case.
Now, Johnson is the only other case we have, besides Clinton, where we actually had an impeachment and a trial. Could you tell us how the trial, or recap for us how the trial made out?
Well, the House managers in this particular case, Thaddeus Stevens, who was the sort of power behind the throne of the radical Republicans in the Senate, really pressed this. He was somebody who felt that Andrew Johnson was being entirely too lenient with the southern states, which had seceded in 1861, they pressed their case with great vigor. Johnson was not a man who enjoyed a high reputation in the public. He was, after all, the successor to the assassinated Abraham Lincoln, and it was said that when he was sworn in as vice president in March 1865, he was drunk on the occasion and had to be steadied by a number of people who were walking him up to take the oath of office. There were no public opinion polls at the time, but he certainly did not enjoy the kind of standing that President Clinton did. And what it came down to in the Senate was, of course, a single vote that the House managers had managed to convince enough senators to convict him and remove him from office, but the final vote was the sort of agonized vote against the removal of Edmund G. Ross, a senator from Kansas, who of course gained later immortality as being one of the case studies in John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage.
Yeah, Ross really has become an American political legend. I think I've seen his name as much as I have anyone else's in the coverage of the Clinton trial.
Yes, there's no question about it. He's gotten kind of a revival. The name had become pretty well familiar to the public when Kennedy's book appeared in the late 1950s, he's gotten a well-deserved resurrection of his reputation. And of course, he later actually migrated, I believe, to New Mexico, led a dignified old age there.
Right. People often mention, because the terminology can be confusing, the Nixon case in the same breath of impeachment. Richard Nixon, however, was not actually impeached. Do you want to just explain that briefly?
Yeah, what happened in the Nixon case was that, and it's well to recall that there were two parallel investigations or considerations of misdeeds of the associated with the Watergate episode. One was in the Senate. That was the committee that was led by Sam Ervin, which looked into the whole Watergate episode and provided a very, very strong evidentiary base for what was later to be the action of the House of Representatives. And what happened was that Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives adopted articles of impeachment against Nixon. And once having done that, but before they could actually, before the House could actually take a vote on it, Nixon resigned. Nixon basically was visited by a number of Republican senators led by Minority Leader Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania, included an old friend Barry Goldwater, who advised him that if the House should in fact impeach, and it was likely that they would, that the chances are that he would be convicted in the Senate. So he made a political determination. He was not going to survive a Senate vote and got out at that time, managed to avoid being the second impeached president, although one against whom articles of impeachment had been recommended by the committee.
Now, one of the other alternatives that has surfaced, although no one seems to be willing to pursue it, it's still in the background, this idea of censuring a president rather than impeaching him or finding him guilty and removing him from office. There is a bit of a history here. The case of Andrew Jackson is the one that's mostly cited. Tell us a little bit about that as an alternative and what you think of it.
Well, what happened was that Andrew Jackson, who had been first elected in 1828, got into a very serious dispute with Congress over something called the Bank of the United States, which was, I suppose, designed to be something like the Bank of England. Jackson opposed it on basically monetary policy. Thought it was a bad thing, and the Senate censured him. After the next election, Jackson's Democratic Party gained strength and the censure was repealed. That tells many people who are opposed to censure that should the Democrats gain strength or perhaps even gain control of the Senate and the House in the election of 2000, that any censure that was issued could be very quickly rescinded. And that is certainly true. The other argument against censure is there is simply no constitutional warrant for it. Nowhere in the Constitution does the word censure apply as regards misdeeds of a president. Now, to say that there is no positive mandate for Congress to censure doesn't mean that they simply couldn't do it. Congress is always doing things which, although not unconstitutional, are certainly extra-constitutional. The Constitution, for example, is very specific about revenue bills originating in the House, but in 1983, a revenue bill originated in the Senate. So it's not as if it's forbidden, but it certainly is not specifically provided for in the Constitution.
Some critics or pundits have suggested that rather than censure, just the fact that, for example, Bill Clinton and Andrew Johnson were impeached, historically, when it comes into the history books, is sufficient punishment. Would you agree with that and dismiss censure as an option?
Yes, I think that to be an impeached president certainly does carry with it historically a very heavy penalty. I think the concern about many Republicans now is, you know, what I consider to have been the ill-advised celebratory reaction on the part of the White House after the House voted impeachment, and that is, of course, the procession of Democratic House members over to the White House to cheer up the president. The feeling was that an impeached president ought to appear more humbled. More contrite. President Clinton appeared defiant, and in some instances, you know, seemed to just blow off the whole event. And this convinced people, of course, that censure would mean almost nothing to him. I think that in some ways, you know, the president has by his own conduct, has kind of conspired in the prolongation of this. I think if the president hadn't practiced this well-known Clinton triumphalism, I think we could well be through the whole process now, but I think people are angry at him. I think people feel that having been impeached, he simply didn't acknowledge it with the proper humility and instead told the members of the House of Representatives to stick it in their ears.
Well, good point. And I think we're going to have to leave it at that. We've run out of time, so thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, Brian. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You've been listening to Ross K. Baker, Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University, and we will return in a moment. Impeachment has been described as the constitutional equivalent of decapitating the president.
Once upon a time, however, attempts to remove governmental officials from office often resulted in actions that were not merely the equivalent of decapitations, but the real thing. Here to tell us about how governmental figures were removed from office in merry old England before the founding of this nation is Daniel Saatchi, alumni professor of history at Auburn University. Professor Saatchi is the author of several books, including Jacobitism and Tory Politics, 1710-1714, and The Jacobites, Britain and Europe, 1688-1788. The title of Professor Saatchi's op-ed is Uneasy Lies the Head That Sleeps in the White House.
There was an ominous, chill quality to proceedings in Congress last week, and rightfully so, for the upper house was solemnly trying the president for his political life. If the Senate now convicts him, the political body of President Clinton will cease to exist. He will, in effect, be executed. But the private, physical body of Citizen Clinton will survive. This was not always the case with grievously erring heads of state in times past. Within the Anglo-American constitutional tradition, the tradition that nurtured the framers of the U.S. Constitution, the consequences of criminal behavior, or simple incapacity, on the part of the chief executive were often much more terrible. So how did the English, who provided the framers with most of their constitutional examples, deal with criminal heads of state in times gone by? What did they do with monarchs who outraged the people? Before 1600, the period most of the English precedents come from, of course, one has to be careful when using concepts like the people. For all practical purposes, the only people who mattered politically were the feudal barons who lorded it over the rest of society from their great castles. Any king who wanted to do anything significant had to have their support, and if he angered them enough, those barons would rebel and wage war against him. Most of the time, the kings won such wars, or were able to negotiate some kind of compromise that left them in power. But sometimes, when the king pushed the barons too far, they would wage war to the death, his. Between 1066 and 1547, 20 kings ruled England, and seven of them, maybe eight, there is a distinct possibility that William II was assassinated, died violent deaths at the hands of their subjects. Some, like Edward II and Henry VI, were defeated, captured, formally deposed by the barons, and then quietly murdered. Others, like Richard I and Richard III, died fighting the rebels. Another two, King Stephen in 1141 and Henry III in 1264, were captured and imprisoned and were lucky to escape with their lives. Though it might look like it, the English barons were not simply being violent for the sake of it. They actually had very few options when it came to dealing with a tyrant king, or one they simply perceived as bad for the community of the realm. Legally, English monarchs were answerable only to God, which meant that the only way to get rid of one for good was to kill him. So regicide, king killing, became the tried and tested, unofficial English form of impeachment of the head of state. Quite rightly, the framers of the U.S. Constitution rejected taking the president's life as an appropriate way of controlling the behavior of the chief executive. Instead, they made the presidency answerable to Congress and substituted a vote of impeachment and a trial in the Senate for war and murder. And so, when the current impeachment process becomes scandalously partisan or downright unfair, it is worth remembering the old English alternative. Even from William Jefferson Clinton's point of view, a modern U.S. impeachment is a considerable improvement on the way things used to be done.
You've been listening to Daniel Saatchi, alumni professor of history at Auburn University, and this is Talking History. Historic site of the week. For this, our special President's Day program on impeachment, we have chosen the Andrew Jensen impeachment website. Here to tell you about this site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Harp Week has just published a free website on the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. It contains over 200 excerpts from Harper's Weekly from 1866 to 1868. You can find the Johnson impeachment website at www.impeach-andrewjohnson.com. The website provides an index of all the legal, constitutional, and political arguments for and against impeachment as they appeared in the Harper's Weekly at that time. Other features include biographies and portraits of 28 leading characters in the drama, 47 illustrations, and 27 cartoons with 16 by Thomas Nast. And there is also an impeachment trial simulation game and a lesson plan for classroom use.
Thank you, Cindy. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, wherein we call to your attention upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else of historical nature that may be of interest to you. And appropriately, we have found events related to American presidents, President George Washington in particular, who died 200 years ago this year. Beginning this week and lasting for 1 year, a furniture and art display will be at George Washington's home, Mount Vernon, in Virginia, titled Mount Vernon as It Was. Artifacts include Washington's presidential chair, his gaming table, and his blue and white Canton china. A number of special events have been planned during the exhibit, so call Mount Vernon for further information. And at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California, until May 30th, is an exhibit titled The Great Experiment, George Washington and the American Republic. The exhibit examines Washington's character and how his personal development was vital in creating the new republic. Featured are 130 manuscripts and rare documents that shed light on Washington's private and public life. Call the Huntington Library in San Marino, California, for further details. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week for our show in honor of Black History Month. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FN in Omaha, this is Brian LeBeau.